Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Gene Alert.
And this is your co-host, Jeffrey Patrick. And on today's show, we have...
Maxine McIntosh from One Health Tech and also the UK.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're going international with it right now.
Yes.
Overseas. Can't wait for you to tune in. Go ahead. Tell them, Gene.
Yes. So tune in right now. It's like Mac, you'll hear, it's a very... very cool conversation. And so tune in right now. Yeah. Peace.
We are amazing because our passion is limitless and our drive is intense. Therefore, you will not deny our grind. You are now listening to the Faith Grind Inspire podcast with your host, Gene Alert.
Welcome back to another great episode of Faith Grind Inspire podcast. I am your host, Gene Alert.
And I am Jeffrey Patrick, your co-host with the most.
And the toast. I love that.
Let's get it.
Today we have a very special guest.
Yes, indeed. When we decided to have Maxine McIntosh, soon to be Dr. McIntosh.
Yes.
I'm not an easily impressed individual. Not at all. Not at all. But I was very impressed with the soon to be Dr. McIntosh, as you guys will also be. So, Maxine, enlighten us a little bit and give us a little... A matter of fact, Maxine is the co-owner of the One Health Tech organization that you guys will get to learn about here in a second. But Maxine, we want you to catch the people up on who you are, where you're from. We're going international on this one, okay? Yeah, we're going international all the way to England.
Shout
London,
out to the Brits.
The big bridge.
This is so incongruous. Thank you so much for having me. So my name is Maxine. I am obviously from the UK, as you can hear from my accent, specifically Oxford. If you're familiar with the different dialects, I definitely have an Oxford accent.
Oxford.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No.
So Jeff and I met each other a couple of days ago now at a Diversity Innovation Hub event at Mount Sinai. It was really great. As I said, I am, fingers crossed, touch wood, on the verge of submitting my PhD, which is working at the intersection of data science and AI and dementia. So that's the idea, to kind of cure dementia using kind of good statistical methods. But my real passion is all about health technology, health tech startups, health tech innovation. And as Jeffrey mentioned, I run this organization called One Health Tech, which supports and promotes better diversity and inclusion in the health tech sector.
Right, exactly. So let's just jump in because I am very interested in building a more diverse and inclusive world. But one of the things that I find problematic, right, and you're gonna expand on this a little bit, is unconscious biases, right? And we want to say, how is it that we can tackle this particular problem? What do you think? That, because you're a data guy or a data lady.
It's okay, I'm one of the few data ladies. So that's an appropriate unconscious bias. Oh, the irony.
There it goes.
There we go. There's your unconscious bias showing straight away.
Right.
So I guess my interest around things like unconscious bias comes more from the fact that whether we have a bias or not, and everyone does have a bias, I work obviously in data and technology. Mm-hmm. And so my interest is in the fact that all of these biases will inherently become automated and built into the systems that we code, the data systems that we create. So I'm particularly interested in the fact that we all have a bias, but the fact that those biases will be automated becomes, I find, for me, a bit scarier, because they will sit behind these data systems, they'll be kind of sitting behind computers, and we won't necessarily see how they're discriminating or not. So an example in healthcare that comes up is, for example, women and men, which is a very kind of popular example at the moment, women and men present with really, really different symptoms of heart attack. And whereas actually, if you look at some of these chatbots that look to kind of diagnose people, they only recognize the symptoms that men have of heart attacks. So if you're a woman having a heart attack and you are saying, actually, you know, my chest feels XYZ and I'm feeling uncomfortable, and you try and go on any of these online services to say what's happening, they are way less likely to pick up your symptoms if you're a woman.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That is what I'm talking about. Those are the unconscious biases that we're going to have to deal with that are becoming automated.
Yeah, and it's because, like, you know, Western medicine has been by and large built by, you know, white men. And so most symptoms are the symptoms that white men exhibit.
Right. The thing is, when you're okay, so when you're building an algorithm to detect a certain type of illness, mm-hmm. a certain type of sickness, a certain type of disease, but you're doing it in this one little area, right? And then you try to take it to another area where the people are and the population are a little different, you're going to find that you're excluding a lot of individuals who need to be, like men and women and heart attacks.
Yeah, totally.
And this is one of the things that I think that we really need to pay attention to. And when it comes to biomedical ethics.
Oh, God. I thought we were talking about startups and that kind of stuff, not ethics. Right,
Patrick right. gets deep.
Oh, yeah, man. Right. No, we're
3 minutes in, man. 3 minutes in. When he said we're going right into it, he meant it.
All right. So let's put it like this. I'll pull back.
No. Go. You've opened up that tin of worms. Go for it now.
No, I'm just, because your undergrad is in biomedical science, is it?
Yeah, so biomedical sciences, neuroscience, then health economics, and I've moved into data science. So you kind of do a bit of ethics around that, but it's you realize that the whole data science healthcare landscape is one big ethical issue.
Yeah. People don't understand that the behaviors of doctors, the behavior of patients, the behavior of allied healthcare workers. These behaviors are really taken into account when you're dealing with certain types of sickness and certain types of disease. And my thing is, right? Okay. I'm going to tell a story, and then you tell me what you think, because I think this is... So, this is a true story, right?
I wasn't expecting it to be a lie, I'll be honest.
No, something that really happened. So I'll use a different name. So let's say Tracy. She's a 19-year-old. And she's on an athletic scholarship at the State University, right? And Stacy is the only child of two immigrant parents who are, you know, here in the country. They don't speak a lot of English. They're coping as much as they possibly can. And 4 years earlier, when she was 15, her mom thought it was odd that she didn't have her menstrual cycle as of yet. So she took her to the only clinic that was available to them, right? When she took them to the clinic to find out why was she not having, the physician referred them to a gynecologist. The gynecologist then found out, through whatever kind of means that were available, that she had no uterus. She had a vagina, but she had no uterus, and she was unable to... He doesn't tell them. He doesn't tell Lucy or the mother, but he does tell them that she'll be unable to have children. Never will she be able to do that. Then the gynecologist refers them to a geneticist, right? The geneticist finds out that Lucy has the XY chromosomes, which makes her a male. She does not possess the double X chromosome. So she's actually, in all scientific way, a boy. But in the physical form, she's a girl. You see what I mean? Okay, so they don't tell Lucy any of the findings, these doctors. They don't tell her. Lucy, remember, she's an athlete. She's a champion, basketball player, track star, and she's on full scholarship at the university. So while training in a local health center for the upcoming athletic season, somehow she's hit in the stomach by a device. She's hit in the stomach, and there is no way to alleviate the pain in her stomach. There's no medication that's treating the pain. She cannot subside the crippling effect of that blow, right? She goes back to the gynecologist. The gynecologist decides to do a, I think it's a, maybe the C scan or MRI, I'm not sure, but They take a look. They take a closer look. And they found two undescended testes. Right? So they don't tell her, but they tell her that there is a cancerous, what would you call it? The a cancerous...
Tumor?
Yeah, right. A tumor. Right. Exactly. And they tell her that she has to go in surgery and remove the tumor. Right? She goes into surgery, and the surgical team automatically figures, like, wait a minute, we're actually not removing a tumor, we're removing two testicles from this person. So the doctor, the surgeon who agrees to do the surgery, him and the gynecologist agree, say, why bother tell her that she's a boy? She's already been living all these years, these 19 years, thinking she's a girl. So let's just cut away the testicles and move on with life. Right?
Wow.
Right. Gosh. So here we come up on an ethical question.
Do you do this for your kind of class all the time? Gene, you know what? You listen to the same story.
This is the first time I heard this story.
No, but I've told Gene plenty of stories.
Yeah, plenty of stories. Not on air, but it's like...
No, but I just wanted to deal with the biomedical ethics and the things that are going on.
Well, okay, so
especially when we're talking about diversity and inclusion and the type of situations that we come across, especially when we're dealing with unconscious biases and dealing with people's autonomy.
So I feel like you've got so many different things going on in there. So my personal feeling is that there's a big difference between omitting advice and information rather than directly lying. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a doctor and I'm not a medical ethicist. So I think that is I'm sure that's a case study you use with some of your students, which is incredibly complicated. With that said, you know, given the fact that lots of your listeners are entrepreneurs, I think if we span this kind of example out, and it's the idea of omitting advice or predicting
exactly
the future.
That's exactly where I was going with it. Lying. There's a truth telling.
Well, so there are so many companies out there and startups that are all about early prediction of conditions.
Yeah.
Can you catch dementia early? Can you catch cancer early? Like every kind of new AI company is around the early detection of these sorts of conditions. And there's tons of startups in the UK doing it, and there's lots of ones in the US as well. And I think 23andMe is a really good kind of real life use case of what happened, in the sense of, if you had a genetic test and it said, you know what, Gene, you're going to get dementia in 20 years. Which is what my research does as well. Would you really want to know that? Because there's not a cure. There's nothing you can do about it. So you will just sit with this information for 20 years. And like, it's useful potentially to know like a couple of years before you're going to get diagnosed, because you've got lots of kind of care planning to do. And, you know, I think it's obviously quite an emotional and sociological and logistical complicated disease to also live with. Mm-hmm. But like, would you want to know 20 years in advance?
No.
No, but like half of these companies out there are saying, we just want to predict these conditions as early as possible. And unless you can do anything about it, I don't really want to know if I've got a condition 20 years before I'm going to have it, especially if I don't have any drugs or medications or surgeries that can remove it.
So truth-telling doesn't become an issue?
It becomes really personal. And I do think if we think about all the technology in the healthcare space, it's all about personalized medicine now. And it's all about individuals being able to have personalized treatments. But also within that, it's also about personalized decision making. And I do think the scenario you gave, I feel, is fairly black and white, in the sense of that just feels morally and ethically incredibly contentious.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing, wanting to know whether you're going to get dementia or not, we've proven and shown that there's a huge range of what people would like to or not like to know about. And actually, we've got to respect the fact that this is going to be something that people massively differ in terms of their personal viewpoints on.
So One Health Tech.
Yeah.
Right.
So we we kind of run as a federated grassroots community that, as I said, supports diversity and inclusion in healthcare. So we have individual hubs that will run their local health technology ecosystems, and they will run everything from meetups to mentorship programs to pitching events to training schemes to profiling diverse and weird and wonderful, wacky entrepreneurs, academics, clinicians. Because in the UK, the NHS, which is our national health service, which is our single payer system, is 77% female, because we've got tons of clinicians who are women. But then when you look at the health technology space, there's about 16% of health technologists are women. And then when you start to look at that from a ethnicity or disability or sexuality perspective, you know, the numbers get really slim.
They're really skinny.
And as you know, and as we've talked about before, if you don't have a diverse group of people who are creating the solutions,
right,
then you're not going to really have the appropriate solutions to the population.
Hence the automation of unconscious biases and putting in what people are not really needing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, and we've got about 13,000 members across the UK and increasing around the world. And, you know, we're setting up a hub in Cairo and in Pakistan.
Yes.
And, you know, it's amazing getting on the call to these people saying, you know, we want to run a program that supports startups working on health apps. And, you know, it's a completely different healthcare landscape. And, you know, my own biases are being challenged all the time, mm-hmm. because I presume
too.
That, you know, that how people view their data is really similar in different settings. But,
right.
you know, in this example in Cairo, they said, well, we can't really think about free data because it's so carefully and heavily controlled by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's happening every single time. So healthcare is one of those incredibly personal things. And with that, you know,
well,
you need the diversity of it.
One of the reasons why I told that story, right, is because I want people to actually think about and actually contemplate where truth-telling falls into this whole scheme of entrepreneurship.
Mm.
You understand? You want to make sure that there are ways for you to actually maneuver through your business and not do things that will put you in a situation where you're considered unethical.
Yeah.
And that the story I just told is one of the most... there are non-maleficent behaviors that are needed throughout this, and unintentional or intentional deception, right? These things are things that we must consider when we do our daily business.
For sure. And we, well, at this event that Jeffrey and I were at,
right.
One of the conversations we had was, mm-hmm. You know, everyone startup, they like to embellish slightly. They have their pitch and you're like, I am so impressed by the hot air that's surrounding your pitch, but you're a very exciting person, but who knows what you're actually doing?
Yeah,
30-second pitch.
But when it comes to healthcare, I just think you can't afford to lie. Like, that is...
No.
It's not like Airbnb
that's
where
true.
You're in someone's bedroom. Like,
no.
It's someone's life.
Yeah, exactly.
And this kind of Silicon Valleyification of healthcare, I find really, really worrying, in the fact that you've got every entrepreneur that feels like they need to have the embellishment, and at times the kind of degree of lying that... lots of these other tech companies have.
Yeah.
And you just can't do that in healthcare.
See, you can't do that in healthcare. Yeah, you're right.
For me, right, I think you cannot have good advice and set a bad example.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot. You cannot do that, especially when it comes to people's lives. You can't just be like, okay, but then when it comes to what you're really supposed to be doing, you're not really doing it. It's not, it doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't, and it shouldn't make sense to anyone who can really put one and one together for any reason. Because we're not all, okay, so in front of the law, we're all equal. We are all 100% equal in front of law, right? But biologically, we're not. We're not all equal, you see? So this is where we can not only just, a matter of fact, I want you to elaborate a little bit on what you think that equity is in healthcare. Yeah.
So again, when he talks about within the context of entrepreneurship, it's particularly relevant, I think, in the UK. So we have the National Health Service, a
yes.
single payer system, which
NHS.
Basically means that we pay our tax. And I never see a bill. I walk into any hospital or primary care physician practice or anywhere, and I just get treated. And it's amazing, absolutely amazing. And, you know, in the UK, our healthcare system is not a healthcare system, it's a religion. So, there are belief systems around religions, just like there are belief systems around our healthcare service. But as I'm sure, you know, everyone here knows, you know, equality is, as you said, treating everyone the same, but equity is acknowledging the fact there are differences.
Right.
Which means that different people will use services in different kinds of ways. So that's, I think, one of the amazing things about the entrepreneurship revolution that's happening mm-hmm. in healthcare mm-hmm. is it says, well, actually, we have a one-size-fits-all solution in the UK in terms of we have a national health service, but mm-hmm. different groups will use services in different ways. So we need to make sure that there are apps that allow people to have simultaneous translation. We need to make sure that people who can't read things particularly well online
right.
have alternatives to get that information.
Right.
You know, the
right.
NHS website
right.
is the biggest source of healthcare information in the world.
Right.
But if you're hard of sight, you can't access that information.
Right, right.
And so it's basically finding who you need to help a little bit more in order for everyone to actually have the fair stab or go at something.
Mm.
And the truth of the matter is that some people have exemptions from paying their taxes, and but should still be treated the same because actually they can't financially afford it. Right. And some people don't need to be helped at all because they're really privileged.
Right, right.
And but then that way everyone gets treated the same ultimately.
Yeah. Obviously. So one health tech, right? What is the biggest challenge to One Health Tech? Because I've been... Go ahead.
Yeah. No, so I think lots of people will run organizations, communities, networks. You can call them different things. They're basically how do you mobilize people in a way that's productive and effective for what you're trying to achieve. And I think we are in a difficult situation because we're trying to run a genuinely federated organization, which means that all of our tools and resources and toolkits that allow different hubs around the world to crop up.
International.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be open. It has to be really easy accessible because actually, if you're federated, people are going to access information at kind of odd times of day in different ways. They're going to have their different colors and shades and tones that will put on their local communities. But they also have to be able to share in a decentralized way information as well. So it's not like a hub and spoke model where we're HQ and we say, right, this is how you run a One Health Tech Hub, go. Because actually, diversity and inclusion in different regions means different things.
Different things. Mm-hmm,
and those hubs have to be able to interact with each other as well as us to them.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that we're basically not extending a kind of British colonial view of saying, this is how you do health technology in Pakistan.
Interoperability.
That is an important word as well, yeah.
Right.
It's interoperability amongst our communities, yeah.
I think
fundamentally having not a top-down organization, and we've got like hundreds of volunteers who run this organization for thousands of members, and doing it genuinely in a federated way, I think is really challenging. And it's challenging also from a funding perspective.
Yeah, I was about to ask you that. That was going to be my next thing.
Where's the money coming from?
Yeah, because it's volunteer-based.
Yeah, so it's volunteer. So it's... I think if you run an organization that's volunteer-led, it's got a beautifully cozy, friendly tone because the people are motivated to work in the organization because they want to. And the moment they don't want to, they leave. And that makes for an incredibly friendly front end of an organization. Obviously, you have to work out, like any volunteer-led organization or charity, we're not a charity, but you have to work out how to incentivize your volunteers. And we always say that you've got to have a selfish and a selfless way while you're kind of working with us.
I like that.
So people say, you know what? I'm sick and tired of being the only black woman in a room. Mm-hmm. And that's my kind of selfless reason is I want to help contribute to that. And the selfish reason is that actually I want to gain and grow my personal profile.
Mm.
And this will allow me to do that. So once we've kind of sorted their motivation out, we still do need some back office funding to support. Like fundamentally, there are admin tasks that volunteer wants to do.
Administrative.
It's so terrible.
Right.
And, you know, pay for running costs, pay for platform costs, you know, pay for meetup groups, all that kind of stuff. And sponsors... and corporate partners, by and large, will pay us, HQ. Now, we've got difficulty then, because if HQ gets paid, then what all these decentralized kind of orbiting hubs, how are they getting their money? And it's really the fact that most companies, I feel, they don't fundamentally understand what a kind of rich and sustainable partnership between organizations looks like. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know what, I want a sponsorship pack where I can see... well, I want a logo on a brochure somewhere. And you're like, man, that is so contrived. And there are very few organizations who understand that actually in order to get these federated communities to keep what's beautiful about them in terms of the federation, you've got to be okay with the fact that your metrics of return on investment will look different to just how many people viewed your logo on that tweet.
So what exactly is the mission? Tell us the mission. I want to know what the mission is. Because then I got some other things that but I'm pretty sure Gene probably got some questions too. But what's the mission of One Health Tech?
So I'm sure, I feel like I should know our mission statement off the top of my head. But I slightly recoil at this the kind of mission, vision, belief stuff because it's helpful for communication, but I don't know, I find it in a British way too rehearsed and contrived.
Right, I got you.
Our mission is to be the platform upon which anyone can build a local by design health technology community.
You know what I like about One Health Tech? It provides a fulsome of learning.
What's a fulsome?
It means all things capable.
Is that a real word?
Look it up. Let's see.
No, I'm into it. Sorry, I interrupted. Go. I'm a fulsome. I like it.
Yeah, it is a real word. But the idea I was trying to get across is that it has a humanistic approach. It has the humane consideration at the forefront. It has this quality that we want to make sure that underrepresented people, underrepresented minorities, underrepresented women, underrepresented, these people are put into the consideration, and there's no exclusion in the company.
Yeah, I mean, we used to run lots of activities, initiatives that would support, for example, lots of entrepreneurs to pitch in front of investors and that sort of thing. And we realized that we just didn't have enough diversity within our own diverse community. And so we actually realized we have to take a step back, and there's a reason why the sector is really pale, male and stale. Mm. And we first of all need to do the legwork to actually collect all these people together who are not that. And then on top of that, we can do lots more, much more exciting activities. But unless you have the people there around in as a receptive audience in the first place, you then can't do all the activities that you want to do. And so that ecosystem building, also given the fact that health tech is still quite a new sector, that ecosystem building has been a really, really crucial bit of what we do. And I think we need to spend more time doing that before we can start to say, well, actually, we've secured X thousand people in these leadership roles. And, you know, we've managed to secure thousands of internships from people from underrepresented groups to go and work in digital health companies. But I'd like to kind of have more stronger and more robust metrics soon, but we just need to work hard on that ecosystem building.
I got you.
That's a, I commend you for all the work that you've done.
And she learned a new word, fulsome.
Have you just looked it up? Yeah. I'm like a total bookworm.
He's
so
full
I
of
love,
them, man.
I love a new word. Fulsome.
So, the pressure's off when it comes down to me, right? So, the show.
I was really into Jeffrey's story.
Yeah, Jeffrey's a lot, man. So, the show is all about the mindset of entrepreneurs, right? So, I want to get into your mindset. First, where did entrepreneurship come? Did you see entrepreneurship growing up? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so no. And I guess One Health Tech never meant to be a thing. I suppose as a child, working in science and technology was always something I was going to do. My parents are very scientific.
Mm-hmm.
And if ultimately I'm a really privileged, white, tertiary educated woman from Oxford. Like, in the grand scheme of things, I literally don't have any barriers, like, at all. People are like, oh, it must be really difficult as a woman.
I'm
a white woman.
Well,
from Oxford.
At least she's like, look, this is the truth.
I met Maxine, and she was just one of the most approachable people I've ever come across.
And she's British. What are the chances? Okay, but
I love it.
The reason why I say that is because, and this was raised before, in order to start an organization or a company in whatever form, that could be a charity, a social enterprise, a limited company, whatever, you do often need a degree of privilege, because even if you don't literally have the capital that sits behind you, you need the psychological safety net that actually, mm-hmm. if it all goes wrong, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you can still go home and have a roof over your head.
Right.
And so I definitely felt very comfortable being like, actually, this what started off as a meetup group has gone to 6,000 people in the first 8 months, and it's just a meetup group. We mm-hmm. need to do something more serious with it.
Wow.
The reason why I then decided to take it further was because I fundamentally had felt like I had that safety net. I'm sure of it. So, entrepreneurialism isn't something I necessarily grew up with, but mm-hmm. I think it's definitely something that I didn't fear either because of that.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, yeah.
So, how did you find your co-founder?
So she is she's twice my age. She's from a northern city called Leeds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really big north-south divide in the UK, right? So there's a kind of joke that people in the south of England, or specifically Oxford, Cambridge, London, don't go beyond the Watford Gap, which is basically just outside of London. So, and she's got two kids, and she works in comms, and mm-hmm. honestly, we couldn't mm-hmm. be more different.
Mm-hmm. That's like Brooklyn and Bronx.
Yeah, probably.
We know people from Brooklyn don't go to the Bronx, though.
Yeah. So it was kind of like that.
And vice versa.
Yeah, vice versa. No, people from the Bronx, they're not allowed in the Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly. So that's that sort of thing. And in the north, everyone's just way more friendly, and people call you like love, and you just, oh, people are so much nicer than in the south of the UK. Anyway, so we met each other at a kind of health technology event, and we were like, man, it is so male, pale, and stale here. This is
I love that.
So lame.
So male, pale, and stale.
No, she was.
And it just. Go ahead, Max. And it was just like, what? This can't be it. Like, they've got to be slightly different people around. And so, as I said, we literally put on a meetup group, and that's how the beginning of One Health Tech started. And it's been, you know.
And your first meetup, you had 6,000 people?
Not the first meetup event, but the meetup like group basically grew to that within the first basically 8 months. And so we thought this feels bigger than meetup.
Yeah. That's amazing. So what do you think the differences are as an entrepreneur in the UK versus what you think an entrepreneur in the US is?
So I'm probably going to say that with the perspective of, okay, whilst I feel like an
based on the biases,
I feel like an accidental entrepreneur, because you know we have to do all the things an entrepreneur does. We have to think about funding, we have to employ people, we have to do accounts, we have to do all the crappy things that's part of being into it. But yeah. I'm probably going to answer that question more on the fact that we've got thousands of digital health entrepreneurs that sit within the organisation that we work a lot with. Honestly, I think it's, and Jeffrey and I talked about this a bit. It's the I'm going to potentially say humility and modesty.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
So there's and you can really see where an American organization has infiltrated an entrepreneurship community in the UK, because they will say meaningless things. They will say like tropish statements about disruption and about, you know, reimagining your ecosystem.
Where's it going?
And stuff like that. And you're like, what does that even mean?
Come on.
I think there's a degree of, there's a caution and a modesty and a humility, which then if you speak to American investors, they will say it's really difficult to get the tenacity that you get of American entrepreneurs when you speak to British entrepreneurs. Like when I speak to American entrepreneurs who are looking to export some of these digital health companies to the US, they're like, it's really hard to get you guys to be more aggressive and tenacious. So I'm not sure which one is better or not. But I think when it comes to healthcare, I personally would prefer to err on the side of caution and not overselling than the other way around.
Exactly.
But that's definitely something I criticized a lot for.
All right. So when it comes to being involved in the community, right? I want you to tell us a little bit about the World Economics Forum and the Global Shapers.
Oh gosh.
you've
just juxtaposed. I'm going to look like the most. Hey, the name of your podcast is In Congress, and you've just teed me up for an In Congress statement as well. So, having spoken about humility and modesty, so the World Economic Forum is informally
the Global Shapers.
I'm sure many people will know. It's the kind of networking conference event for all the kind of global leaders around the world. And they have a division of it that helps kind of young people from around the world to be supported in kind of leadership and entrepreneurship and social impact by effectively grooming them into the World Economic Forum.
Right, right.
So they kind of like coach you to be part of their slightly overambitious crew.
Right, right.
And I find it a fascinating group to be part of, because everyone is kind of early 30s. And they're working on incredible companies or initiatives or charities, or they're kind of political people. Mm-hmm. And there's a real kind of range and breadth of people. But they're all millennials. Mm-hmm. And you do really realize there's this kind of need for millennials to be a co-founder of something. And I'm sure you guys see this a lot through your podcast and conversations you have, that there feels like a very big difference between a kind of tokenistic founding and one that you kind of is a bit of the grind of the founding.
Right.
And one thing I find very interesting about the Global Shapers, which again is effectively an organization, a kind of subdivision of an organization that helps kind of young leaders aspire to be and fulfill their leadership potential, is you have lots of millennials who are trying on the hat of being world leaders in a slightly disingenuous way. So, for example, saying, you know, # I'm so humbled to have done my 15th TED talk. And you think, well, like, yeah, fine. And that, again, that's absolutely fine. But it's like you go through the motions of what you feel you should be doing as an ambitious entrepreneur. And it just doesn't feel very genuine.
Mm.
And I'm saying this as someone who's done two TED Talks, so I'm aware of the irony in everything I've just said.
Yeah, right.
She said, I've done two.
No, she's...
That's cool.
No, I'm telling you, I was impressed with...
So how was that experience?
Oh, terrible. Oh, gosh. So speaking of the kind of Americanification of things, there's a style that you do a TED Talk. I'm not sure if you've seen the Meta TED Talk where the guy stands up and goes, I'm going to stand up on stage and just... pan the room and ask you a really profound rhetorical question. And then I'm going to touch my laptop to make it seem like I'm really intellectual. Anyway, and he power narrates an entire TED Talk and you realize that the whole thing is like a cookie cutter joke. And right. It's just theater.
Right.
And it's so funny. Anyway, with that said, the kind of TEDx thing and TED thing really coaches you to speak in a particular way and to narrate in a particular way. And it's a lot more about theater than it is about content.
Mm.
And I think that can be misleading. And I think you see that a lot in the entrepreneurship community.
Mm-hmm.
That you feel you have to have the .io domain and the swishy mm-hmm. design deck mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you have to communicate in the disruption ecosystem type language,
mm-hmm.
whether you are wanting to or comfortable or not. And I think that's a really definitely the same example here as well.
I think as an entrepreneur that you have to constantly, like, if anything else you don't do, you have to constantly groom yourself, right? You got to constantly tame yourself. You got to constantly remind yourself of the things that need to be done in order for you to be successful and be influential to people who are watching, because you are being observed whether you like it, yes or no. So you have to be mindful. You have to be mindful of what you're doing, what you're saying, and how you're acting.
I don't know. I'm going to challenge that, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
Because as part of wrapped up in the... again, everything I say is within the context of technology. I've got a very myopic existence in terms of the technology entrepreneurship landscape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there is this cult of personality. Like, you used to start a company in med tech, and it would be, I don't know, medx.com.
Right.
And it was like, it just did what it's, you know, a generic med tech company. And you would never know who the founder was because they're just doing their thing of like solving that disease and just cracking on with it. Whereas there's this cult of personality that now surrounds every single technology startup, almost every single technology startup I see now. And it's so much about the person who started it. And it becomes very synonymous with the problem and the solution they're providing, which feels wrong because it should be about the fact that they're creating an amazing company. But instead,
to help people. More of like an ego thing.
Kind of, yeah. I think like the egoness around, well, the egotisticalness around the entrepreneurship landscape in technology, I find very, very damaging. And you used influence, and I think influence is the right word that I think is incorrectly used a lot within technology entrepreneurship. If you are a tech founder, and we have literally thousands of tech founders within One Health Tech, and you can really see the ones that are most successful don't use personal influence. Like, they just about network enough to make sure that they can leverage their network well, but you don't see them on stage at every conference and pitching all the time and prolific on Twitter, because they're just being much more careful about, I need to run a company and be really impactful like that, and this is not about my personal profile.
So what do you think about the statement, don't chase the money, consider the impact that you're making?
I mean, I'll say that to a founder that's been like fundraising for 3 years and struggling. I don't know. It's yes and no. There's nothing wrong with chasing the money. You know, like, you've got to chase the money because you've got to have your company, funded.
Right.
But I wouldn't chase the profile. It's probably the way I would change that.
The profile.
Like, don't chase a profile.
What is your definition of profile?
As an influence and personal recognition.
Yeah.
Rather than,
I think what you're saying is, don't promote yourself more than you're promoting your business.
And
most of the time, I think some entrepreneurs believe, if I promote myself more, then people will see the product because they'll like me, and then I'll be able to raise money.
Yeah.
Two.
Isn't that your philosophy?
No, it's not. No, it's not. My frozen yogurt is the best in New York City. So I don't need to promote anything.
But it's a really fine balance. But to full circle, you know, with One Health Tech, it started off as a thing in an organization.
It just so happens. You know, I'm just joking. Go ahead.
You know, it started off as a thing that I, as an individual with another woman, set up a meetup group, and then it grew on the back of our personal profile. And we've worked really hard to disaggregate the community and the impact it has in our personal existence. So I'm like, I'm saying no to every speaking thing at the moment. I'm putting lots of other people forward instead.
Thank you for coming here.
You were wearing such an abrasive and beautiful blazer. I was like, I'm not sure what I've signed up to, but this guy is 10 out of 10.
As always.
But architecting that redundancy so that my name is not synonymous with One Health Tech has been a really long process, and I'm hopefully close to there. But
Maxine, how do you balance your business life and your family life?
See, we always ask. That's a good. You know, what's so funny, Pac. We always ask the men that question.
Yeah, right.
But we never ask the women.
Right, right. You're like the first one that's getting that question.
I'm very confused by what biases you guys have. It's very, very inconsistent.
We're both married men, 10 years, 20 years. So we always ask the men that come in here like, yeah, we're entrepreneurs. We do our thing. We grind. We put it to work. And we go, how do you balance? You know?
So I actually do One Health Tech on the side of my PhD. So I'm about to finish this PhD. Thank God. And I've been doing that and One Health Tech simultaneously, which...
She's a Winston Churchill Fellow, just in case.
So the reason why I'm hanging out in New York is I'm here on a fellowship, which is great fun.
Winston Churchill
Fellow. Winston Churchill Fellowship, specifically.
Check Winston Churchill if you don't know who that is.
Yeah. Google.
Maybe not. He's like not an amazing guy when you actually go and Google him. He's a pretty bad guy. Yeah. Anyway.
But you said it.
So it's more the fact that I think when... early stage companies, organizations, and it's probably what a lot of people do, they will have like a primary job and they'll have a side hustle, and then after a bit the side hustle gets big enough. And I never wanted to make the side hustle my full job. And I don't know why. I'll probably interrogate that's why that's the issue, but it's flown away without me, which is nice. So to answer your question, I am childless, which I find incredibly lovely because it means I can work whenever I want. But I do have a pre-husband. But having said that, I almost don't have a pre-husband because yesterday I was fiddling with my engagement ring and it fell into the Hudson River. Luckily, it landed on a ledge just underneath the dock.
That is a beautiful ring.
Oh, it's like cheapy cheapy, but nevertheless meaningful and sentimental. So I almost don't have a fiance.
Wow, you dropped it into the Hudson.
Oh my goodness.
And I only got it on Saturday.
What is his name?
We've been engaged for a year and a half, but I've been wearing a different ring. His name is Alexander.
Alexander.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much for not dumping Maxine for dropping that ring.
But so he runs a digital health company. Entrepreneur.
And he's an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And the fact that we have a 24/7 schedule, both of us, means that we break and work.
Alexander, come down to the show.
I think he's roaming somewhere in the area, I suspect. That definitely makes a massive difference. To have a partner who has an equally flexible and also full-on schedule means that, you know, when you both decide to break... It's a similar level of sacrifice for both people.
Yeah, yeah. You need that.
Yeah.
Because everybody see eye to eye and they understand what's really going on, what's really at stake.
Yeah.
It's not so much being in the house with you, it's what we got to do. We have things to do.
And we run completely different businesses. You know, his is like a standard product.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Alexander, come down to the show.
Yeah.
Come talk.
But two entrepreneurs together makes sense. You know, it's really difficult when you have two people in different fields. You know, an entrepreneur never turns off, you know, unless they want to turn off. You know, my pastor says when you work, when you play. So when it's family time, that's your play time. So don't think about work and be, so it doesn't matter how much time you spend, but it's what you do when you're spending during that time with your family.
Do you find it easy to sort of switch off completely?
No.
Like, how do you still your mind?
It's very difficult. For me, it's very difficult. You know, I've been, every day I get better. You know, I try to balance it the best that I can. But because I'm in very different markets, I have podcast clients, I have real estate clients, and real estate clients need to see you on the weekend, you know, or after work. I have ACA, which is a media print type of business. So those clients is early morning, You know, they don't care in the afternoon. So then I have a 3-year-old.
Oh, my word.
So he needs attention. And then I have Patrick, and then he needs attention.
He's probably more attention than 3-year-old, so, I suspect. That's right.
The best person that can really get me is Tim, because me and Tim, man, like, Tim just, look, this is it, you know? So, but, yeah, so, I mean, I've been working on the balance, and it's, I'm getting there.
Yeah.
But it's a challenge. It definitely is.
People talk about meditation, and oh my God, I get so bored. They're like,
see, you know, I do meditate.
Gina and I.
And you can handle it. Oh my God. Oh,
No.
Gina and I are two different people.
I meditate in the morning.
We're two different people.
It's about 15 minutes.
Wow. And it's, you've just got someone being like, listen.
No. I have a mantra that I say.
No,
I don't do those type of meditation. It's just literally 15 minutes in the morning, and just to still my mind, you know, because while I'm dreaming, I'm sleeping, I'm thinking about work, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about how my day is going to play. I'm thinking about this interview, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm thinking about what's going to happen throughout Thursday or Friday, or, you know, mm-hmm. and so I try to, so I have control over my day. I meditate just to control my, you know, all the things that I have to get done, you know, it's just to help me, you know, and that's what I've been an entrepreneur for 20 years.
Wow.
And so it's just been one of the things that helps me stand still and keep moving forward. You know, that's probably why I'm still married. So meditation and prayer.
Two different people.
Yeah.
And you're like, I just...
When I'm on the phone with this guy,
cheeseburgers.
I'm telling him all the things I'm doing. He's like, I can't be you.
There's no need for me to be like that, because I have a totally different approach.
You're just chill all the time.
Not chill. But I zero in. I'm a zero in kind of guy. And I make sure whatever I zero in on is what I'm going to get done. And more importantly, I'm a deep thinker.
No.
Yeah. We would have guessed that one. Tim's like, really?
I am a deep thinker. And there's a, I don't know where I got it from, but something, there's a philosophical thinking that when I work, I work. When I pray, God works. You see what I'm saying? So that mentality, that psychological thinking, let me know that I will know whatever is in the light or in the dark, because I have that ability. So that's my approach towards being. He's been an entrepreneur for 20 years. I've been an entrepreneur since I was born.
I'm not sure how that manifests to a 4-year-old, but
right.
I'd love to see
that. I was walking when I was 6 months,
but
to let you know the kind of guy I was.
Yeah. He was nice. Did he tell you he was in a coma for like a year?
I was in a coma for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
There's a good margin of error there, don't worry.
Yeah,
what's a 50 other weeks?
This guy is like, he's a Superman.
But one thing I find interesting, though, is that, you know, people will write, you know, a Medium article about this is what my schedule and my lifestyle is as an entrepreneur. And there is this, a huge degree of survivor bias, and say, you know, actually, because I wake up at 5 a.m. or because I do this
survivor
is why I'm 6
bias.
And that, really annoys me.
Yes.
And survivor. B, it feels as such a preachy thing.
Yes.
It's like, you know what? This is how to run the company. Yes. This is my narcissistic, self-indulgent routine.
And I
find it so rare to see, like, a genuine conversation amongst different types of entrepreneurs. And again, I feel like I'm a faux entrepreneur, but to see people saying, like, actually, just this is my schedule, without the earnestness of the kind of narcissism around this is how you should do it because I do it in that way.
I just remember where I got that. When I work, and when I pray, God works. Pastor Joy told me that. I just remembered. Pastor Joy, this is one of our pastors at our church. She kind of took me aside and told me that what I need to do is this. You know, and I think that plays a role in my life, and I think that makes a difference, because there's a lot of people who don't actually, practice what they preach.
Mm.
See what I'm saying? So, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna say?
Mm-hmm. I would say preach, but at the same time, I'm not particularly religious, so that would feel somewhat insulting and disingenuous to
myself.
We're
going international. What's the Royal Society like? Come on, tell us a little bit about the Royal Society.
This is the thing about the UK. It's just got so many slightly silly named organizations.
I love it. I would like to be a member of the Royal Society.
Yeah, so, that sounds,
so, oh,
that
gosh. Sounds... so if you are a fellow of the Royal Society, yeah, that means that you are literally one of the world's greatest scientists.
Yes. Tell them.
So that, I mean, never say never.
Right.
You're starting pretty late to be a fellow of the Royal Society, right, but right. I don't want to be a naysayer and say you can't get there.
No, you never. No, see, you, as long as you're not dead, you'll be surprised what can happen.
Yeah,
in life.
No, true. So the Royal Society is the UK's Institute for Science,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and it's one of the oldest scientific institutions in the world, and it's got incredible.
Are you
libraries.
A fellow?
No, I mean, you literally have to be a Nobel Prize winner.
Mm.
And then it's only like some of the Nobel Prize winners get to be one.
I hear you.
But it's interesting because in the UK you've got tons of these very, very prestigious old, basically like old boys clubs,
yeah, right,
that have become these institutions of the UK. And meanwhile, right, you have this kind of throbbing entrepreneurial ecosystem around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone's in a WeWork. And I just feel like I'd love to just dust off these really incredible buildings in central London, just full of portraits of, you know, freshly old white men, and just put all these entrepreneurs that are kind of scrabbling for space and scrabbling for care and mm-hmm. scrabbling for places to work into these buildings, because it just feels like it would be such a better use of what are these incredible kind of old buildings.
That's, see, we're going international, and I love that idea, because I want us to reach as many people, and I want us to create a more inclusive society, and I want us to be wise in the way that we attack unconscious biases and check those unconscious biases. So what would your role at the deep-minded the Deep Mind Health Independent Review Board, what was that at all? To tell us a little bit, enlighten us.
Yes.
So this, I think, is very relevant for kind of companies or entrepreneurs that are trying to think about ethics.
Right.
And everyone's like, we need to be an ethical company when it comes to AI and technology.
Right.
Like, everyone definitely pays lip service
right.
to ethics.
Right.
So DeepMind, as some people might know, is effectively the research division of AI of Google. So mm-hmm. Google acquired DeepMind, which is an AI company, a few years ago. And it's pretty much the most, if not one of the most exciting AI companies in this space. And they work across lots of different areas. They work across kind of pure AI research
mm-hmm.
And also applied areas. They work across climate change and health
mm-hmm.
and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they wanted to do is that they had various partnerships with the NHS, the healthcare system in the UK, and also other healthcare systems around the world,
mm-hmm.
applying cool AI to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, we want to practice what we preach
mm-hmm.
and think really ethically about how we do what we do.
Right.
And imagine, you know, it's effectively like being in the bowels of Google and trying to think about ethics. You know, it's like a, you know, where do you start?
Right.
And
right.
so they set up a thing called an independent review board. And the purpose of the board was to meet periodically and to effectively provide an ethical audit for what was happening in DeepMind. And it was a really, really interesting thing, because what you realized is that when you've got startups or big companies working with the healthcare system, and remember, the healthcare system in the US, in the UK, is a religion and a belief system. It is not a healthcare service.
Mm-hmm.
That people have incredibly strong opinions about what sort of companies should or shouldn't be working with the healthcare system, how they should be working with it, what does ethics really look like. So we talked about everything from, are they training their algorithms on diverse populations, to transparency about their commercial model, so mm-hmm. people feel confident, like they can trust the organizations,
mm-hmm.
to how do they work really deeply and genuinely with patients and the public, to whether they take interoperability really seriously, so that actually they're our fair player in the health technology ecosystem.
Right.
And we kind of looked at everything. What about
security and privacy?
All of that stuff as well. But you know, we really had access to everything. And really importantly, we didn't sign any non-disclosure agreements.
Mm.
So, you know, that's literally like having access to any level of seniority effectively within
mm-hmm,
Google.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And being able to say whatever you want to say.
Wow.
And I think that was quite a powerful lever
for
us.
Yeah, that is powerful.
If there was something that we fundamentally disagreed with that happened in the organization, we had the power to technically go to the press and say, this is what this company is doing. You should be watching this.
Mm.
Now, the whole thing slightly fell apart in some respects when, whilst DeepMind was acquired by Google, they were a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year ago, Google has now decided to really focus in on health, and they set up a Google Health division, and they've basically consolidated lots of the health initiatives across Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, into one entity, i.e. Google Health. And so DeepMind Health
right.
was subsumed into that.
Mm-hmm.
And from the British public's perspective, this was the single most ethically contentious thing. They were like, we're okay with this organization DeepMind working with our health service, mm-hmm. but we don't want anything to do with Google. And everyone was very worried that all of a sudden health data would be linked to Google data and sold and all that kind of stuff. And though none of that happens, the sheer fact that DeepMind moved to Google mm-hmm. really, really upset people.
And so
we were ultimately closed down, which I find sad and ironic. It was an interesting experiment because I think that actually to operationalize ethics, and DeepMind is a fairly new company still, I think to operationalize ethics is very, very difficult. And I kind of commend the senior leadership for having a go at trying to do it in practice.
Yeah. That is like... That is a feat that it would carry on for aeons, just trying to make things happen ethically.
Yeah, and companies, I think lots of entrepreneurs are trying to use that as a selling point now. They're saying, you know, we're an ethical company.
Yeah.
And then when you look at actually what they do and how they do it, there's like nothing particularly ethical about it.
Right,
but they're just using it as a kind of, almost like a marketing thing.
Yeah, see, when it comes to beneficent behavior, okay, the beneficent behavior is not so much a non-maleficent behavior. They're not the same. Mm. One is not to do any harm, and the other one is to prevent any kind of harm, do any kind of harm. So these things are important for people to actually realize when it comes to delivering justice. Justice becomes a very important thing. And if you're dealing, I don't care what company you're in, right? You must be concerned with delivering the right and proper justice.
Mm-hmm.
You must. This is something that you have to contemplate. This is something you have to consider. This is something that you should not waver from.
Yeah, but if you're there to maximize shareholder value,
you
it's really tricky.
It is tricky.
We spend so long kind of agonizing over the way that big pharmaceutical companies work. And we're seeing the same thing happening in the health technology ecosystem where you've got tons of entrepreneurs that are set up no differently.
See, that's my thing. If you're at... Okay, so you... Sovereignty. A lot of people do not consider sovereignty.
Hey, I'm from the UK. A lot of people consider sovereignty, I'll be honest.
And that's why I
mentioned
it.
Don't mention Brexit.
That's why I mentioned it. I'm talking about... Yeah, I'm talking about it over here. Over there and over where you're from.
Why do we have not something stronger than water? Come on.
We might have to introduce that, Jeff.
Sovereignty. You, of all people right now, should realize that it comes into play. And people don't really consider it because... Those who are in the high... This is one of the things that I find bothersome is that a lot of people who are in the position that they're at that know more, do more, and can actually prevent certain things from happening, they don't do it. Mm-hmm. They're in a position to make things happen, but they're not doing it. And I'm finding that a problematic area for us, for society in the whole. Go ahead.
So to kind of circle back, mm-hmm. that's... Also, why I'm absolutely fascinated with decentralized communities.
Yeah.
Because actually, it's the whole point of the fact that, you know, you don't know everything, you don't know everything.
That's right.
And so how do you kind of harness the power of the crowd?
Yeah.
But provide the framework by which the crowd can operate more efficiently, effectively together.
Yeah.
Because actually, as a white middle class, Oxford dwelling, tertiary educated person, I'm not in the best position to really be dictating what diversity and representation and inclusion really means for health tech.
Right.
But if I can create the environment and like we architect so carefully, then and we can allow those best ideas and solutions to bubble up.
That's why Dr. Etienne and I have decided to take on the course on multiculturalism in medicine. Multiculturalism in medicine is ultimately dealing with, or better yet, challenging. It's challenging the cohorts to actually deal with the more and the growing multicultural patient population. People need to understand that their way of thinking must change. It has to change, and everything has to change in a way where it is more uplifting to our society on a whole, right?
Mm-hmm.
And being an instructor for this course, being an instructor of medicine, being an instructor of this, I get to see or I get to hear a lot from the students. And these students are now thinking so different, especially when they're coming through the course, because the trajectory of the course, right, it has the hidden agenda of dealing with these unconscious biases, but it doesn't blatantly comes out, because you will be psychologically, you will be, or better yet, you can restrain. You can actually restrain people by the words you use. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? So it's important for us to take a closer look at how we're interacting. That interpersonal connectivity is very important. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad I met you, because we saw eye to eye, even though
we're different heights, judging by your hand gestures.
Yes, equitable.
I'm so glad I was at your chest height. Yep, that was wonderful.
All right, go ahead, Gene.
Maxine, attention off.
Every time Jeffrey's on the go, you're like, breathe.
Yeah. So what characteristics do you think makes up a good entrepreneur?
Alexander knows. We should ask him.
Now she knows.
I'm trying to use my words carefully. The problem with some of these words is they get used a lot, but they're still
useful. That's fine.
So I do think authenticity is so important.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is again, through the almost corporatization of entrepreneurialism, which I find inherently quite ironic, mm-hmm. There's increasingly feels like a cookie cutter way to be an entrepreneur. So mm-hmm. I think those entrepreneurs that are confident in their own style, and you know, just like the woman from Radical Health on this event we were on Monday, she was like loving the fact that she was from the Bronx.
Yeah,
and like she was like, I don't care that this isn't where a son of an entrepreneur is from, like I am from the Bronx.
She was adamant.
Yeah.
But that's kind of great. So I think the authenticity is really important. Mm-hmm. Obviously I would say that a kind of very, very sound attention to energy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where you're getting it from, mm-hmm. have you got enough, are you recouping well, mm-hmm. who's taking your energy, who you're giving it to, where you're spending your energy, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. And I guess my third thing would be probably actually, you know, what you said struck me a bit in terms of being able to hone in. I think you've got to be kind of laser focused on what your outcome is, mm-hmm. and not be too fixated on the route by which to get there, mm-hmm. because everyone will know that when you start a company, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or any kind of organization, you will change and pivot and rehash and restructure, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, I think we've been through like four company structures because a community is inherently complicated, and you've got to be okay with the fact that actually the method by which to get to what your ultimate, you know, mission or vision or goal or outcome, whatever you want to call it, is really laser focused, and you've got to be okay with like just binning stuff. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think the flexibility in the route, I think, is the last thing I would say is probably very important.
Yeah, I love it.
All right, great.
We ask all our guests one question, right? Out of the three words, faith, grind, inspire, which one resonates with you?
I like the fact that you've got faith and then grind is capital letters. So it's like faith, grind, inspire. Right. You know what? I'm going to say grind because it's just so odd within that triumvirate of words. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's that kind of like inconsistency and the fact that lots of entrepreneurs will have often like a refined pitch or refined way they present themselves, and like behind it they're, you know, tired and, you know, exhausted, mm-hmm. and through gritted teeth will continue to go for it. In order to achieve the fulsome. So I think probably grind. You know, we see so many entrepreneurs who pass through the community.
Yeah. Gene and I are grind guys.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, probably grind. Most people are grind because so faith.
You'll be surprised.
I'm not a spiritual person, so I'm not going to say faith. Inspire feels too egocentrical and kind of individually focused and influenced. Right. So maybe by method of elimination, I've just got.
But the interesting thing, right? Everybody that's an entrepreneur has all three words. Even you.
How would you say? Where's my faith?
Talk to me about starting the business.
Faith in yourself.
Faith in yourself. Right? Mm. Yeah. Faith in what you're doing. You do have faith in yourself.
Faith in myself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Then the grind, you already know the work, trust the process. But then you inspire
thousands of people.
You inspired me.
Yeah, you inspired him. You inspired me.
Okay, okay, I'm British and this is getting too personal. I can't do it.
And it's all about you,
no,
right?
No, can't finish it. What did we have for breakfast?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, no, but everybody has it. You know, it's the faith in yourself, the work that you put in will inspire others to do whatever they need to do in their lives to achieve their vision.
Right.
You know, and that's really the goal. You know, to it's however you want to inspire people. Some people want to inspire people by telling them about themselves. You know, some people want to inspire people by the work that they do. Some people want to inspire people by the lives that they save. You know, like, so everyone inspires someone, you know. Jeff inspires me all the time, you know.
Vice versa.
You're a sartorial inspiration for
yeah.
me, for sure.
And look, Jeff's blazer inspired you.
Yeah, I'm usually
peacocking. But that's everybody.
I know, I'm usually peacocking my fashion way more because I'm traveling at the moment. I'm feeling really light.
It's
and
okay.
No, it's cool. It's all cool. Right. We appreciate.
No, we're going to go into high society mode here in a second.
I was more for like kind of leopard print leotards and that's
all. All right, Maxime McIntosh.
So where can people find you?
Yeah.
How can people, any yeah, last
not,
words?
Not on my home address. where can people find me? I'm on Twitter at Maxi_Mackie, and the E sound is an I, not a Y. So Maxi_Mackie. It's probably the most efficient way.
Okay.
Yeah, and One Health Tech is at @One_HealthTech.
All right.
Any website?
www.onehealthtech.com.
Yeah,
cool,
definitely.
Or just Google One Health Tech.
One Health Tech.
SEO, it's there.
I love it.
Yeah, it's there.
I love it. So,
yeah,
ladies and gentlemen,
Maxime McIntosh.
Maxine. So, thank you so much, Maxine, for coming
soon
on.
To be Dr. McIntosh.
Yes, yes, I love it. I look forward to that.
I look forward to that.
Yes, and congrats. You got to invite us to the wedding.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I got engaged a year and a half ago. So.
It's okay.
We haven't even started.
No,
yeah, I was engaged for 2 years.
Oh, you'll good. Right. That's mm-hmm. good. That's a sort of survivor bias I need.
Yes. 2 years. Mm-hmm. I said, but that was the plan. You know, we said we're going to get engaged, be engaged for 2 years, know each other, build with each other, understand how it is to be together and then get married.
Yeah, I feel like when you get engaged, you basically make the commitment already.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
You know, it's weird to me when people just get engaged and get married like a month later, you know, and I'm like, you don't really know how it is to be together. But anyway, whatever.
No, it's not.
That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, it's not for you.
But anyway, so I want to thank our listeners. I want to thank our producer, Tim, and Brianna.
Yeah.
I want to thank all of you guys out there in podcast land for always tuning in every Wednesday consistently for the last year and a half. Appreciate you. We wouldn't be here without you guys. So tune in, share,
and thank
subscribe.
You, Maxine, for coming in.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Thanks so much for inviting me on what was quite an unusual conversation.
Yes. Thanks, Jeff.
No, these things happen.
So appreciate it. Jeff is the man.
These things happen.
But always remember, keep grinding, keep shining, and keep going no matter what.
No
God
matter
bless.
What. Peace. Later.